Good evening, all. John B. Kennedy speaking from the NBC newsroom in Radio City, New York. Let's look at Asia for a change instead of Europe, for a minute at least. If you were disturbed last night in your slumber, say about 3 o'clock in the morning, considering the time differential, it wasn't by echoes of the thunder of the German and British guns, which, as a matter of fact, were relatively quiet last night. It was by the echoes of an angry demonstration by Japanese in Shanghai, demanding an apology from the United States for that alleged assault on Japanese police by U.S. Marines, who incidentally mistook the police for hoodlums bent on attacking a Japanese general. Colonel DeWitt Peck, U.S. Marine commander in Shanghai, kept a cool head. He made no apology. He simply said he was waiting to get all the evidence and would patiently consider all of it. But when told that local Japanese insisted that his Marines disarm, he calmly replied that such an order must come not from Shanghai or Tokyo, but from Washington. Evidently, the military have seized full control in Japan, with Prince Konoye as premier, a blue-blooded aristocrat of the shoguns, which means democracy in Japan is taking an airing. The British, in their stress or distress, closed the Burma Road at Japan's demand, despite United States' protest that the road is the only avenue for supplies to China, which, strangely enough, is the reason why Japan wanted the road closed. Significant is the fact that Japan made demands to close the road before, but they were not heeded, until German success made the Japanese more cocky, or, as the diplomats say, more realistic. Japan is on her way to something, perhaps Hong Kong and the Dutch East Indies. It points an old and practical motto: Europe's trouble is Nippon's opportunity. The United States today vigorously protested Japan's action, but the Japanese reply seems to be, not America's business, please. There's a tip from German sources that the blitzkrieg on Britain must get through before summer, for the Germans admit that bad weather over the channel has halted their airmen even now, despite the fact that sailors of the Dutch freighter Zimmerberg, just into Boston from England, say that ports in South Wales and England have been terribly bombed, many ships being sunk while riding anchor. Airspeed enables both sides to spring surprises, for the British today report successful raids deep into Reich territory and the demoralization of material assembly at Calais and elsewhere for the invasion of Britain, if, when, and how. If bad summer weather stops the Germans, German blow, it will have to call an intermission for winter when fog prevails. But news that up from Romania, three enormous tank car caravans of fuel to supply 1,000 planes for 45 days are on their way to France indicates that the Nazis are getting ready. The amazing thing is that when you talk to the English in London, as we do every night from this NBC studio, they, far from gloomy, are even gay. For instance, a little Cockney radio engineer just now, asked if he was getting scared, replied, "What of? Cheerio." Well, now for this late news abroad. We broadcast by NBC war reporters in London and Rome. First, we go to Great Britain. Please go ahead, London.
This is London at about 18 minutes past midnight. John McVane speaking. Tonight, I'm going to tell you a little more about the British defense preparations I saw in a two-day inspection of parts of the country that may at any hour be the new war front. The place was a famous British port. For obvious reasons, I am not allowed to be more explicit. A young Navy lieutenant commander was our guide. In the harbor were sleek destroyers, submarines, armed trawlers, and other craft. This harbor is a regular boarding house, the naval officer said. We have every type of vessel in the fleet coming in here from time to time, but none of them stay with us permanently. He explained that the submarines spent long spells at sea hunting for enemy vessels. After a few hours or days in port, they went out for another long period. Our guide was himself a submarine officer. Someone asked him why he chose what many sailors call the most dangerous work of all. "Oh, there are compensations," said the officer, laughing. "At least you're your own boss, and that's something to think of." The port has been raided by bombers, but no damage was done. When you saw the number of anti-aircraft guns each vessel could bring into action, you understood why Nazi planes might not want to investigate the port at close quarters. On the docks were trucks carrying anti-aircraft guns and crews. The sailors who made up the gun crews showed us how they went into action against enemy planes. They moved with a snap and a sort of cocky efficiency that you see everywhere in the British Navy. I think it must be because the men honestly think their Navy is the finest in the world. They have a morale that comes from being the rulers of the seas, at least in this part of the world. They have never met anything they weren't sure they could lick. So even when something like the Graf von Spee comes along, they go ahead and prove they can lick it. It's worth £1 million for a sailor to get in a car and fight on land, the commander said. They think it's great fun to get ashore once in a while. To prove his point, he showed us how the Navy was protecting the harbor. He explained that the harbor was a strategic point that the enemy were fairly likely to attack. But they'll have to get past our land defenses first, he said. On one side of the harbor, groups of sailors were digging trenches and making sandbag defenses. Naval guns on land were sighted on the approaches a landing party of Germans would have to make. They will have to come in under our shelling, the officer said. Barbed wire laid by the Navy formed a line of defense. Machine guns in concrete and sandbag pillboxes covered the meadows over which the Germans would have to advance. We have ordered our men to give them everything when they reach the barbed wire, an officer said. Another Navy officer dressed in khaki explained with pride the trenches his men had just built. Sailors with rifles would keep up a steady fire on the enemy advancing over open ground to supplement the work of the machine guns and the artillery. Of course, the Army will be around here to help us, but these defense works are all our own work and our own responsibility, he said. The entire area, controlled by the Navy, was strewn with defense works of various types. What will you do about parachutists, I asked. Suppose the Germans don't try to make a landing where you expect it. Our men are pretty good shots, the officer said. Parachutists can't land anywhere in this area without coming under our fire if we don't get them in the air. We're ready for landing anywhere, but the coastline I showed you is the only one that's practical for them. I asked one of the men whether he thought he and his mates could hold off a big German force. He smiled and said, we've beaten them every time we've met them at sea. Maybe here we'll have a chance to show the Army a thing or two about beating them on land. They can come any time. We're ready for them. This is John McVane in London, returning you to the National Broadcasting Company in New York.
Back in New York for a quick switch to get the news as of now in Italy. Go ahead, NBC reporter in Rome.
Hello, NBC. This is Charles Lanius in Rome. Naturally, the war on the African continent now holds the greatest interest for the large majority of the Italian people. For it's under the broiling African sun in the Badlands and on the suffocating dusty desert that fascist manhood is fighting. And from reports reaching Rome, it looks like Mussolini's soldiers are winning victories there. Today it's announced that the Italian flag floats over the new hilltop fort at Moyale in Kenya. Black shirts and native troops crossed over the Ethiopian frontier several weeks ago and besieged the town until it fell yesterday. Although Moyale doesn't appear to be more than another African village on your map, it's really a strategic point. The British took it over in 1915 and developed it into an important trading center. And whoever is in possession of the town controls the highways and the indispensable trade routes which reach out into Kenya. Now, with the cutting of the British Dolo salient, which was reported yesterday, the Italians can now consolidate their new positions all the way from Lake Rudolfo to the frontier of Italian Somaliland. And incidentally, by smashing the salient, the fascists have shortened their front by about 300 miles. Now, further north, Italian native troops managed to capture Gezan, a British post on the Anglo-Egyptian Sudan, between Kermak and Galabat. Gezan is on the Blue Nile and dominates the important caravan trail. This means, of course, that the Italians have advanced into the Sudan all along the Abyssinian frontier. Today's official war communique admits the British have bombarded the Italian Red Sea ports of Assab and Asmara and the inland town of Agorda. In Libya, they also raided the port of Tobruk. According to the Italians, none of these attacks caused much damage, but one British plane was shot down. The fascists retaliated by bombing airports and barracks at Marsa Matruh and Sidi Barani on the Egyptian coast. They also claimed to have bombed Alexandria again, all their planes returning safely. In an air battle over Malta, they report two British planes were downed, while only one Italian plane was lost. A British attack on Capuzzo on the Cyrenaica frontier with Egypt, in which the British are said to have used 50 tanks protected by smoke screens, was beaten back, according to the bulletin. In the eastern Mediterranean, it's reported that an Italian submarine sunk an oil tanker. But the bulletin adds that an Italian submarine has failed to return to its base. The Italian naval losses since the war began were announced today. The casualties include 610 officers and men dead. That's to say 325 known dead and 285 lost. 149 officers and men were wounded. At the same time, the names of 74 naval officers and men who have won decorations since the war started were published. Now, a story in the Giornale d'Italia tonight forecasts a possible trade war between the new Europe and the United States. According to this dispatch, which is said to have come from Buenos Aires, there is widespread conviction in the United States that should England fall, the New York would form a tremendous bloc, which would dominate world economics. So the USA is attempting to corner South American surpluses. Then North America would be in a position to deny all raw materials and foodstuffs to Europe, should this continent refuse to recognize the plutocratic imperialism of the dollar. And, concludes the story, this aggressive economic policy is being organized under the mask of neighborly politics. Mrs. Myron Taylor, wife of President Roosevelt's special envoy to the Vatican, who, as you probably know, recently underwent a serious operation here, had half an hour's private audience with the Pope today. I understand that Mr. Taylor, who is convalescing under the care of Dr. Raphael Bacinelli, Senior Mussolini's private physician, will be able to leave the clinic tomorrow. He and Mrs. Taylor will return to their home at Florence for the time being. This is Charles Lanius in Rome. I now return you to NBC in New York.
Thank you, Rome. Kennedy again. Well, here's Spain talking up loud. Yesterday, she cut Chile off her visiting list, and today, General Franco, who wears medals by preference and wounds by proxy, is demanding that Gibraltar be returned to Spain by Britain, which took it in the days when international burglary was the vogue, a vogue that seems to be being revived. But with all the difference of opinion, there's grim humor in Marshal Goering's assertion that if any of his airmen kill any of his English friends, he'll send flowers by the very next plane. That used to be the method of the Chicago gunmen who sent so many wreaths to rivals bumped off that they soon found it cheaper to grow their own flowers. Well, here's further agreement among the warring nations. The Berlin Kladderdatsch and London Punch, both humorous papers suspected of being funny on occasions, say that the war's a bust because there's so very little humor in it. And incidentally, both agree that the idea of the Duke and Duchess of Windsor taking a clipper for the Bahamas in New York is a good thing. Europe is busier with more serious matters, they say. But to have humor in a war, you have to have Americans in it, and that's much too expensive a way of getting fun. The best joke in the World War was that of the American doughboy being given the Croix de Guerre and kissed by a French general. He said he wanted another medal for the kiss. And the smartest practical gag unmatched in this rapid-fire ruin of today was Johnny Evers, the old Tinkers to Evers to Chance veteran. Johnny refereed a ball game between two fighting artillery and infantry teams. He made a hairline decision, and one team and its supporters roared for his scalp. Johnny halted the game. He tipped the army band to play the national anthem and walked off the field unmolested. In Chicago, Peppery Senator Pepper of Florida demanded a plank today in the Democratic platform calling for all aid to Great Britain short of war. Now, there's a familiar and a strange phrase. For helping one nation to make war on another is at least being an accessory, if not an ally. And if that's what the United States wants to be, it's big enough and brave enough to do the thing outright and not flanked by phrases. But Senator Pepper's bold demand meets with bold opposition. And it's predicted that while an outright anti-war plank may not be part of the platform, there will be no definite declaration of participation short of war. There isn't the slightest doubt that the American people on the whole are pulling for Britain. The Gallup polls demonstrate this conclusively. But the American people are aware that their defenses are very weak. We made a newsreel picture the other night of a new American anti-tank defense, a 75-millimeter gun that could blow a tank to bits. Well, it did. But the tank was a 1918 vintage that would have fallen apart anyway. And the gun crew would have had no chance to get set with a blitzkrieg German fortress on rubber blasting them. Preparedness, preparedness, and more preparedness is the one worthwhile platform for America today. This is John B. Kennedy suggesting respectfully you keep tuned to this station this evening for the latest news from Europe and for up-to-the-minute reports from the Democratic National Convention in Chicago. Also, please join us again tomorrow evening at this same time for another glimpse of what's going on in Europe. Good night, all.
This closes the news for the present on the European situation. We have heard from London, England. We have also heard from Rome, Italy. And we heard from John B. Kennedy in our own NBC newsroom in New York City. This is the National Broadcasting Company, RCA Building, Radio City, New York.